Welcome to the Whole Self Podcast, where we talk about various mental health topics with an emphasis on the body, mind, and spirit connection. Our goal is to empower our listeners with the knowledge and tools needed to embark on their own healing journey. A gentle reminder that this podcast is not a substitute for therapy, and we encourage you to seek out your own therapy if needed.
Hi, welcome to Whole Self Podcast. I'm Sharon Wegman.
I'm Kayla Cedar.
And today we're going to be joined by a guest to help us talk about the four boxes that society puts men in, and specifically tied to how society puts men in boxes tied to sexuality and other gender-related things. All right, so I'm going to be introducing Matt Owen. So Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? We felt like you were a good fit for this podcast because we know some of your specialties. So tell us about what you do.
Sure, yeah. Thanks, Sharon. Thanks, Kayla. My background as a therapist began as a substance abuse treatment provider. I've been in that field for the better part of 12 years in some various different roles, from what we sometimes call a clinical technician or counselor assistant up through chaplaincy and spiritual counseling. And for about the past 4 years, both inpatient and outpatient therapy. I've specialized over the course of the last decade in treating healthcare providers, so I frequently work with doctors, nurses, other therapists, and in addition to substance abuse treatment, have focused a lot in recent years on PTSD, grief and loss issues, and overall search for meaning, purpose, other spiritual care concerns.
Great. And Matt is part of the More Resilient Group, which is located in Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, in the same suite that Wellsprings is located in. And we're going to recap the last episode and why we're discussing today's topic.
Yeah, thanks, Sharon. So last time, we were really talking about how some traditional gender roles can affect women's sexuality. We were looking at the four main reasons why women's libido might be affected in marriages, why we might be seeing a lower sex drive. So that podcast was in response to a couple other parts in the series. So looking at the mental load, looking at weaponized incompetency, looking at boundaries, how do I have these conversations in my marriage, and then looking at how is my sexuality being affected by marriage. So by more so traditional gender roles. So we thought that today might be a great opportunity to invite Matt in to speak on behalf of how does society maybe put men in some boxes. So and just to clarify, you know, we aren't, the intentionality behind this is an invitation to look at how might I be socialized, and how am I socialized in a way where I might be having some negative beliefs about self. So this isn't an intentionality to shame or dishonor the feminine, shame or dishonor the masculine. We're really just looking at, who do I have to be in order to be acceptable in this world? And we've spent quite a bit of time looking at that for women. Who do I have to be in order to be acceptable in this world? What messages do I get that then I'm making moral meaning of myself? So we really just want to spend some time today looking at what does that mean for the masculine then, for the masculine part of that. So we kind of came up with four different areas that we were really hoping to learn about. The first one being social engagement. So Matt, could you speak a little bit to what is that like to be for a male at a young age or as you're going through life? What are some social messages you get about social engagement?
Sure. I base a lot of this on my own experience growing up in the particular family and geographic location I grew up in, the spiritual influences on my life. They are probably unique to me in certain ways, although they seem to be universal in a lot of other ways. Mm-hmm. In larger culture, if we could use words like Western culture. They're probably a little different in other cultures. And there's, I think, always a nuance between saying what is masculine, what is feminine, or even if we said there was a continuum, what counts as more masculine than or farther down to this pole. So a lot of this is always contextual. And in Western American culture, there seems to be a limited number of things that men can do socially to engage with each other. And perhaps now, where the world's grown isolated and divided, maybe these things stand out as problematic in a much more severe way or problematic way. Things like that is, men or male identified individuals can engage in sports, in exercise, in drinking culture, in a lot of ways in general that promote some proximity to other people, and they limit a lot of actual emotional vulnerability, closeness. So bars, drinking, gambling, if you've, not that women can't do these things, if you, though, think of what bars look like, they might be very noisy, conversation very superficial. At a casino, people, what we call them slot jockeys, all lined up next to each other and quite close, within touching distance, and no actual interaction. And so there's maybe from that societal perspective, things I'm allowed to do. That was certainly what I learned. When you were old enough, you were going to spend time at the bar. Sunday afternoon during football games was going to be spent away from family. See lots of memes or jokes about how families are saying goodbye to their husbands for the next 6 months as they prepare to deal with the upcoming football season. Full disclosure, football fan here. Go Eagles. Idea, though, that I can't have any sort of vulnerable relationships with those individuals that I might be watching a game with or having a beer with, that those more vulnerable conversations are taboo, or you wouldn't want to ruin the ambiance of the experience by actually having a human conversation that might include things like sadness or disappointment, fear, hopelessness, that men are supposed to be the strong, silent type and weather those storms without much in the way of help from, especially from other men. Maybe part of that social engagement would be the presumption you were going to have a partner in this culture, of course. And where I grew up, it was presumed you were going to have a female partner, and maybe she would be your one emotional outlet. And that's a lot to put on a partner, of course, to be the sole outlet for one other person.
That's really powerful stuff. I feel like what we see is many women experience that men is not doing the social engagement that they want them to do, but really they haven't really, it's not acceptable. It's not the norm. It's not what they've been taught.
And some things are quite good, like going to the gym. And I'm guilty of, like, I'll leave earbuds in even if they're not charged, because when I'm in the gym, I don't really want to have a high degree of intimate interactions with people. I want to maximize the time I have in there. I want to not get cold. I don't want to hurt myself in that way. I don't want to try to make up for the hour I set aside to be in the gym in 5 minutes because I've spent 55 minutes interacting. So while there could be good reason to do things that are conventionally masculine along the lines of health or self-regulation, the problem is there's not a lot of other outlets, at least that, like, we've been offered or that I was taught to engage with.
Yeah, definitely. And that's just a very small box, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When I think about it in emotional connection or what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, it is a very small box.
Yeah, so I'm even thinking, like, and I might be jumping the gun a little bit here and moving into the emotional health aspect of this, but, like, it almost, what I'm hearing is there are certain limitations around what is and is not acceptable, around what are we, not only just what are we doing during social engagement, but what are we discussing? What does that conversation look like? And is there connection being had during this, or kind of like what you said, there's a proximity but not that emotional closeness? And I'm wondering too if, like, you know, even if we just bring it back to some like basic social learning stuff, right? I think it's some, like, and someone correct me if you know differently, some 80% of learning is through observation alone. So these may not be these explicit messages of, hey, you don't show up to a bar being sad, like, and well, you can, but don't talk about it. Just keep ordering your beers, dude, and like be quiet. So how does this happen that you know? That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely, it makes sense. And you observe the older kids, or like, yeah, you start off on a team, and you know, when we're quite young, it's usually in 4-year increments where you learn from the older guys on the team, mm-hmm, and you model yourself after their behavior, how to dress, how to act, what is cool. And certainly those things can be helpful if the older guys on the team had some emotional vulnerability, or I think sports can be great outlets, or being a part of a team can help people find some respite from what might be dangerous or at least unhealthy situations back home, if you get the right kind of coach that can pull you up and takes an interest in you beyond just your athletic skills. Like, that can be great. Just, I think we see those things rightfully as the exceptions to the rule in our culture. It's why we make TV shows about them. It's why they're like the human interest feel good stories when a coach actually like goes that extra mile. And it's not to demean coaches. Like, I've had really good ones. It's that there's usually something else where, particularly along the lines of sex, as we're getting older, like one of those boxes is around sex as something that's an achievement, or that you can start feeling more confident in yourself as a male at a quite early age, because we're not out there. Another one that comes along later is like, how much do we earn? How much can we provide? How much of a protector can we be? But even before we have the opportunity for all that, we can, you know, of course, from like teenage years up, we can start having sex. And that is certainly something that's like a notch on your belt, or you get more approval, you get more stature, the more sex that you have. And of course, for women, it's quite the opposite to that. To have multiple partners for a man as an achievement, it's something you would use, like, maybe in a more derogatory way to conceptualize a female sexuality. So, I think there's a lot that sort of extrapolates from that, or that's like, that's a core issue that a lot of others can really start to spring from, like the stuff around bar culture, gambling, like the vice in general probably is related to how we first learn to explore our sexuality.
Yeah, and I think what we grieve for men who only are given this box as a way to find approval. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're really trying to go for here is recognize, yes, there are things that women have been placed in boxes, but there are many boxes that men have been placed in, and some of the restraints are pretty damaging to their emotional health, which we'll get into in a minute. So yesterday I was having a conversation, and we were talking a lot with a client who came from purity culture, and talking about how purity culture has damaged the view of sexuality for both men and women. And it's interesting how we'll have many people in the purity culture, which is more Christian-based, faith-based, who are focused on the extreme desire of sex that men have and not the extreme desire that women might have. And so women are supposed to reduce their sexuality and or care for the sexuality needs of men. And so we were kind of just debunking that thought, because I remember when I was a youth group leader many years ago, the male youth group leader told me that men think about sex every 30 seconds. And I was like, and he was like quoting this statistic. And I was wondering, what, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. And then we found a statistic yesterday that says, according to this study, that the truth of the matter is men might think about sex 19 times a day. And that's also applicable to women as well. And it's interesting that once we debunk it by actual research-based statistics, instead of what is passed down through cultures or bar talk, that we can really recognize that the sexual needs are very similar between men and women, but for some reason there has been a
pathologized.
that desire is pathologized in men.
Yeah.
But not in women.
Or both so too, right?
If
we're looking at pathologized to mean like what is wrong, what is diagnosable, what is the issue here? So there's no issue for men's sexuality, if I'm understanding this correctly, and Matt, you're here to correct us. And to speak on that is how do we pathologize sexuality in women then? How do we say what's right and wrong, good and bad? This is acceptable, this is unacceptable, right? So yeah, Sharon, what are we passing down? Even Matt, what you were saying, like, okay, so I'm learning from the older kids, right? What are they doing and what have they learned? And how do we just pass down these messages of what is and is not acceptable for me to do, even in the sexuality realm.
It's interesting that you get these bombardments of message both on the side of from purity culture and from whatever we might want to call that locker room talk.
Sure.
Or I know that's a term that's been used, that we're told to have these simultaneous competing, or maybe like you'll grow out of one kind of desire, but they're both sort of limited. We make these assumptions about all the way back to Freud, and we even the parts of Freud we don't take as gospel truth anymore. We still very much believe that his conceptualization of human behavior being primarily oriented to the nuclear family, and that there's unconscious repressed desires happening that explains so much of our pathology, that those are hardly givens based on what we know about the human condition and lots of other researchers and thinkers that have from before him and after him have said about desire, and that we often make arbitrary value judgments or rank orders out of this desire is wrong, this desire is acceptable, so that I suppose whether it's to have as many partners outside of marriage before you get there, and then to have a lot of sex in your own marriage and create as many babies as you possibly can, that those things are notches on your belt. So individuals who either choose or cannot have children in this culture are simultaneously thought of as deficient, or something must be wrong with that individual. So that the truth, again, is much more nuanced around what can or can't be healthy. Doesn't have to do with the definition itself. Or in working with addictions, we've of course mostly treat drugs and alcohol, and then some other things that are perhaps just a little bit less common but still very prevalent in our culture: sex addiction, gambling, food. It would seem that anything that is a way to distract yourself from your feelings, perhaps to be dealing with these things that we're told we cannot feel or we should not be feeling, can become addictive. Any way in which I'm regulating my mood in a more auto-regulatory way, to use a fancy psych term, instead of maybe how we're built as human beings to regulate ourselves in community through authentic, vulnerable relationships. either side of that pole can be damaging to that, the locker room culture or the purity culture.
That's really big, because basically we're saying that men don't have a lot of outlets to deal with feelings they're not supposed to talk about.
Right.
To that end, that's where a lot of addictions kick in, because they're not allowed to talk about vulnerable things and feelings. They're only allowed to experience maybe a desire for sex or a desire for anger. And that's a small box that men then, even if they're not using sex, drugs, gambling, whatever, they could be using work, because that's acceptable. That's acceptable in the culture.
Well, and that ability to provide, or I don't know when we first started using words like being emasculated, but like certainly that's used so often. If you're like the not the breadwinner in the relationship, or the way that stay-home dads are sometimes thought of as deficient.
Right.
Like, well, you must not be much in the way of a provider, or who wears the pants in this relationship? Those sorts of statements, where those are, of course, quite arbitrary distinctions that do not reflect anything in the realm of like what is actually healthy, or even what might be like practically functional for a family. So the thinking of ourselves differently in ways where our desires can point in a lot of directions in healthy ways, that it's not about the desire itself. There are probably a few things out there, of course we see them in our therapy work, where it's a pretty limited range of desires where we would say, like, well, that's clearly unhealthy, or that's clearly rooted in some deeper pathology. The desire for different forms of sexual, emotional, romantic connection. We were pathologizing homosexuality not all that long ago. We were, and from the legal perspective, it wasn't all that long ago that a man could not be charged with raping his wife inside a marriage. It was very recently in our society's history where those sorts of things were not the givens, or the contrary to those things were not the givens that we assume they've been for a very long time.
Yeah, these are powerful statements. Okay, so we've kind of talked about how men have been socialized with social engagement, with sexuality, how they handle their emotional health. And, you know, Matt delved into the idea of household relationship, what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do, right? And that kind of brings back to some of the things that we were talking about in the two or three previous podcasts, where we were specifically talking about gender roles and the mental load. Please refer to these podcasts that we did in this series, because they were, it's helpful for me as a female to recognize that for a man who has been socialized a specific way, it can feel emasculating to take on roles that have been traditionally female.
Yeah, and if I'm hearing it right, it's not just an internalization of that emasculation. It's this external, too, of, you know, oh, what are people saying? What are people thinking? Like, this outside view of who wears the pants in the family, right? Or in the relationship. So I'm wondering, so what does that look like then when we consider that it is traditionally the woman carrying the mental load when it comes to household management, when it comes to child rearing, even when both partners are out of the home working and maybe dividing the income of the house equally, there still seems to be this pattern where the brunt of the labor, household management labor, gets put on the woman still. What's up with that?
I'll tell you what's up with that.
He's on the hot seat now.
I believe it has a lot to do with how our society has evolved, and the income inequality that's in our society. For better or for worse, there was I think in a lot of ways for the better, a man could go work in a factory and still be the sole breadwinner and provide enough that his wife would not have to go to work.
True.
And that could provide for all four children and put them through college. And nowadays that is absolutely impossible. Even the
yes.
best of jobs, union jobs, are not paying those kinds of wages commensurate with the cost of living. So there is rarely, except for the upper echelon of earners, the ability for one person in the relationship to be at home, and while the other is the sole breadwinner. So we still have all this conditioning, though, saying that women should be, you know, managing chores and rearing the children. And when a man gets home from a hard day of work, it's time for him to check out or to check in with the bottle or go off to the bar or fill in the blank of these more traditional roles we've talked about, where now the woman is also coming home from work exhausted and tired, yet still having this incredible mental and physical demands being placed on her. Of course, again, like as always, nuance, and we're, you know, talking like as if there are only heterosexual couples and how that dynamic could play out differently in other forms of relationships. It's a complicated issue.
It is a complicated, and I really value the idea that men used to be the breadwinners and women used to take care of all those things, and that's no longer the case. We cannot do that financially. So that means how we do things has to shift. So how can men move out of these boxes?
Well, they're and maybe these are more emerging options, or they're more available in certain places as a substance abuse counselor.
Mm.
Things like 12-step fellowships offer a great example. And I think a lot of other sorts of support groups are taking cues from 12-step as time moves forward. That's a relatively recent inclusion in our society. I just saw, maybe it was yesterday or today, but the basic text for Alcoholics Anonymous is 85 years old. So that form of connection and fellowship is not even a century old. And maybe it reflects an older way of being where people were more authentically in, I would even use the word, communion with each other, that they could bring real vulnerability, that they could find genuine support, they could find lack of judgment, lack of competition, lack of hierarchy. So anywhere that you can find that kind of community where maybe some of those pieces of this more toxic materialist culture or competition culture are absent. And that takes some intentionality. It's not the easiest thing to create, and there are a lot of groups along these lines that now that we've gotten a little bit more savvy because of COVID with gathering in virtual ways, that maybe it's a little easier, or maybe one might be a little bit more inclined to dip their toes in these waters of more vulnerable sorts of interactions, because I don't have to do it in person. It can be anonymous. It can be where I don't know how this is going to feel, or if somebody saw me at a group like this, how would I be perceived? A little easier to engage that virtually.
Yeah. And there's so many online support groups now than there used to be. But we still need that human connection. You know, and I often tell my clients, I'm like, look for environments that are altruistic, that are giving environments. 12-step groups would be that, you know, where there's mentors, sponsors, even some church situations, not all, and maybe support groups that are tied to specialized populations that are more volunteer-based. You're going to find people who are givers.
Yeah.
And what I think we're hoping for from this podcast is that females would have a different perspective of the boxes that men have been placed in. And men, as they listen to this, will recognize the boxes they've been placed in.
And this isn't to... This is to educate, right? Because the more information that I have, the more I'm able to name something, the more empowered I am to do something differently about it. Please don't hear us saying, oh yeah, cool, this is it, and this is where it ends, right? It's, please hear this as an invitation of hope and to choose to do something differently within this, because one thing that Sharon and I have keep coming back to, and Sharon said it very clearly last time, is if you know differently, you can do differently, and if you want something different for the generation that you're raising, then you're going to have to socialize a little differently. In order to socialize a little differently, you're going to have to deconstruct internally what you have been brought up to learn and know and how you operate in the world. Mm. So that puts great opportunity on us to do something differently.
Yeah, and that's why almost every podcast we have, actually every podcast we have, we're talking about how therapy is so powerful to deconstruct the thoughts that you have. And even if you're in a married relationship, to have that third party helping you understand each other better. And heal that wound so that you can break the cycles for your future generations. And therapy is almost one of the primary ways that people do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to be able to see this from a perspective free of shame, that even if we do feel at times some guilt for the ways these conditioned ways of being have harmed other people in our lives, or certainly have harmed ourselves, that we would like to take some ownership, we would like to make different choices or make amends when that's appropriate, to not feel like I'm a bad person because I have this, or up to this point I've seen myself through this lens. It's hard to think of it in any other way as inescapable. We don't choose the culture, we don't choose the values that we're born into. So it comes back to a lot of things that I explore with my patients in therapy, that whatever this is, your addiction, your trauma, it's not your fault. Healing it is going to be your responsibility, because no one can really heal this for you. I think I've sometimes jokingly, sometimes, you know, quite seriously said to patients, like, if I could snap my fingers and make this different for you, I would love to be able to provide that service. I might be a millionaire if I had that trick. And the only way to really heal it is to go through it, not to sidestep it. Because all of what we've been talking about is ways to sidestep our suffering and to keep it hidden and keep it in the background of experience where we cannot really perceive it. And as therapists, we know that doesn't work too well for too long.
No, so good, so good. Very powerful having you here today, Matt. I love that last statement. Do not shame yourself for what you have learned. But you now have the choice to move out of the boxes that you have, that have been created for you, and or you have maintained. Now that you know different, you can do different. Thanks for joining us today. If this was helpful, be sure to subscribe and leave a 5-star review for our podcast. For more mental health content, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Whole Self Therapists. Thanks so much, Matt. Thanks, Kayla.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening. Any resources or links from today's episode can be found in our show notes. Original music in this episode is by Christopher Burkholder.